This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. All of us like to think of ourselves as informed citizens, but how much of Watergate do you remember from the events and how much from All the President's Men? The movie version of The Grapes of Wrath is a crucial part of our picture of the Dust Bowl and the Depression. The first 20 minutes of Saving Private Ryan is D-Day to a lot of us. For good or ill, our collective memory of American history is formed as much by Hollywood as by historians. Film and television versions of history are often less than scrupulous with the facts. Events are telescoped, motives simplified. The filmmaker or the studio may have an agenda, but whether it's war, politics, sports, or culture, the study of what we think we know from the movies is critical to understanding how we think about our past. Later in the program, a look at the TV network's sales pitch to advertisers last week, what's in next season's schedule and what isn't, but first, American history on film. How have the movies shaped your image of our country's past? Has a movie ever inspired you to learn more about a period or an event in history? Our number in Washington, 800-989-8255, that's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Peter Rollins joins us now from the studios of member station KWGS in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He's a professor of English and American Film Studies at Oklahoma State University and the editor of the newly published The Columbia Companion to American History on Film, How the Movies Have Portrayed the American Past. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Glad to be here, Neil.
This is a pretty hefty book. It's 600 pages and more before you get to the index. But if you were only trying to correct historical inaccuracy in movies, it'd be a lot longer than that, wouldn't it?
Well, I guess our concern is not always inaccuracy of interpretation, since historians interpret history as well. But what we try to do in this book is compare and contrast how professional historians portray our past, and then look at the various films and what interpretations they have made of the same events.
Mm-hmm. So just as an acknowledgement, your book does discuss television, films, a series, documentaries. Today we're just going to focus on feature films, but since we've defined the films that way, and you're talking a little bit about how you define history, would you expand that? How are you thinking about history in this context?
Well, we actually had a little bit of controversy in the Chronicle of Higher Education a few months back, and there was a Simon Schama show called Murder at Harvard, and there were various historians brought onto the program to indicate what history was as opposed to what motion pictures do, and at least four of them said that history is a collection of facts and that history is always based on fact. And of course, what they said was totally untrue. History is an interpretation of facts, and the use of imagination is implied. And this is also true in motion pictures, and in many cases, filmmakers work very hard to interpret the past. So when we're talking about history versus film, it's not fact versus fiction so much as one interpretation versus another interpretation.
Yet the history of Hollywood is replete with examples where the movie makers simply ignored even facts that are undisputed.
Oh, absolutely, and we take that type of film to task. On the other hand, the classic film Birth of a Nation of 1914, which made motion pictures really an art form, was concurrent, or it was consonant with the historical interpretation, the so-called tragic interpretation of Reconstruction of its own time. It really was in harmony with the historians. However, when we look back now, we understand that both the historians and the film were way off. They were racist. They misrepresented the Old South. They misrepresented Reconstruction. So in that case, both the historians and the films deserve a hit.
But the fact that D.W. Griffith was expressing a view that was consonant with at least some historians' interpretations of that period.
Absolutely. In fact, the reigning historians, William Dunning and U.B. Phillips. Phillips was the author of Life and Labor in the Old South. And, of course, in your excellent introduction, you mentioned Woodrow Wilson saying that this film was history written with lightning. And Wilson himself, of course, was a major historian. In fact, started the first Ph.D. program in history in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And obviously was at Princeton, but from the South himself originally.
Absolutely. Of course, this is another thing historians do bring to bear in their interpretation of their past experiences. And, of course, you've already mentioned collective memory. They are part of the collective memory as well, although they do research in libraries and with the original documents, we hope.
Now, one of the points you make in this book is that there are three main ways in which histories tell, which movies tell history. Describe them for us.
Well, Film and History, our magazine, and this book, The Columbia Companion, sort of separate films out into three different approaches to history. Films are designed to interpret history, to explain the nature of historical events or historical personages to the public. Films which the second category, films that reflect history, and in some cases these are films that are not intending to be factually accurate, maybe not even intentionally discussing historical topic, but when we go back to look at these films, they tell us so much about the past in which they were made. And then the third category are films that are consciously made to impact on history and to change historical events by changing collective memory.
Well, let's take those one at a time. And talking about films that interpret history, I know you argue that one of them is Citizen Kane, the great Orson Welles movie. Many would argue, and do vociferously, maybe the best movie of all time. But we see this as a Romano Clef, in part, you know, sort of a thinly disguised history of William Randolph Hearst. But you say it goes beyond that.
Well, as Citizen Kane... Young Charlie Keene is, and the older Citizen Kane is, a microcosm for the United States. That is, just as the United States began as an agrarian economy, a small-town nation, and evolved to an industrial and urban economy, an urban nation, so the life of Charles Foster Kane involves his being torn away from agrarian roots and agrarian values and thrown down in the middle of the urban industrial world. So the trials and tribulations of Charles Foster Kane are not just something related to a fictional character or even William Randolph Hearst, who was an influence on the film, but also Charlie is a microcosm of the United States and its evolution as well.
And also the understanding that we all reach at the beginning of the film, indeed, when we see the wreckage of Xanadu, that some of the achievements simply of wealth can be very empty. Here's a scene from Citizen Kane. It's set in the vast, barren, and echoing room in Kane's grotesque marble palace that he sets in Florida. It's a conversation between Citizen Kane, Charles Foster Kane, played by Orson Welles, and his second wife, the young Susan Alexander Kane, played by Dorothy Common Gore.
So what time is it in New York?
11:30.
Night?
Mm-hmm. Bulldog's just gone to press.
Well, hooray for the bulldog. Gee, 11:30. Shows are just getting up. People are going to nightclubs and restaurants. Of course, we're different because we live in a palace.
You always said you wanted to live in a palace.
Oh, a person could go crazy in this dump. Nobody to talk to, nobody to have any fun with.
Susan.
49,000 acres of nothing but scenery and statues. I'm lonesome.
Till just yesterday, we've had no less than 50 of your friends at any one time. I think if you look carefully in the West Wing, Susan, you'll find about a dozen vacationers still in residence.
You make a joke out of everything. Charlie, I want to go to New York. I'm tired of being a hostess. I want to have fun. Please, Charlie.
Well, you could really hear Orson Welles' background in radio in that clip and in many other places in that movie.
Absolutely. Yeah. What's interesting to me about that particular clip is that it really is a comment on the success myth. Americans believe in the success myth. It goes all the way back to Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, which is a study how an individual made him a success, made himself a success. And in this particular scene, late in Citizen Kane, we're seeing the loneliness, the ennui, the alienation that unfortunately can often be the end of the road for a self-serving, self-made man. And the echoes there are echoes of that symbolize the loneliness and emptiness of that life.
Yeah, we all, anybody who's ever seen that scene can immediately envision that gigantic fireplace there at the end of that enormous table in that very empty room. Anyway, if you'd like to join our conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And let's begin with Jeff, who joins us from Athens, Ohio.
Great, Neil. It's wonderful to be on here.
Oh, thanks very much for calling.
Yeah. Well, here's my my comment. I was a little bit your guest was talking about how what filmmakers do with history is interpretation. He was basically saying that that's what professional historians do. Is that professional historians don't deal with facts. That what we do is interpret as well. I'm a PhD student in American history, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I take issue with that, because what filmmakers do is interpretation, but historians, his panel that he talked about at Harvard, they were correct, is that we deal with facts, not interpretation. I mean, there are facts. And of course, we also interpret the facts, But there are such a things as facts that historians do know. It's not all just interpretation.
Well, I'm glad to receive a call like that. I want you to know they did not pay the person to call in. The point of view that he is stating is pretty much what was in the murder at Harvard. And I certainly am not denying that there are facts. That's ridiculous. But if you look at... let's say a history of the Roosevelt administration, Arthur Schlesinger Jr.'s three-volume History of the Age of Roosevelt. I mean, that thing reads like a novel. It's certainly based on fact, but what gives it life is the passion and interpretation of someone who really was enamored with Roosevelt and supported and believed in what Roosevelt was trying to do. So that's a very clear case of someone who used a lot of imagination to tie facts together, and that's what history is.
And is that what historical filmmaking is?
Well,
facts. Hello.
Well, this is a good question. Let the caller speak first.
Jeff, why don't you go ahead?
What was the question again?
Well, my question was: is that what historical filmmakers are doing? The same thing as historians?
No. I mean, they can be done. But we peer-reviewed journals, peer-reviewed books, and it's not the same sort of, rigor of, that is applied. It can be done, but it's extraordinarily difficult. But there's often this slippery slope where, people will talk about history as being just interpretation. And one thing I think, at least as far as I'm trained, is that, we try very hard. We're trained that, there are such things as facts, that, years upon years of research by all different scholars, that you can decide we do know this about a certain president. We do know that. There are, history is grounded in facts, at least good history. But I appreciate your program. I'll listen to any comments off the air.
Okay, Jeff, I think your cell phone is making the decision for you anyway, but thanks very much for the call. Did you have a response, Professor Rollins?
I think Jeff has revised his initial statement, and I can't disagree with what he said. It is very hard to make a historical film that respects the facts. Too often, filmmakers and scriptwriters are interested in what is called a story arc. And in a story arc, you end up with a full character, but you have to start with a lesser developed one.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many cases of film where the personality or achievements of a real ones are diminished and demeaned in the early part of the film, which in point of fact the person was very much a success and as great as he would have been at the end of whatever story they're telling, but are shaped and formed to create what's called a story arc. There are films, in fact, these have been discussed at the American Historical Association meeting since 1970. There actually are films that are made by historians that are very fact-specific, however, utilize the wonderful language of the visual and oral medium of film to accomplish factual interpretations.
We're talking about American history on film, and when we come back from a short break, we'll take more of your calls. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, totn@npr.org. Do you get your history from the silver screen? I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing American history on film. Our guest is Peter Rollins, editor-in-chief of the journal Film and History and author and editor of many books on film. The latest is the Columbia Companion to American History on Film, How Movies Have Portrayed the American Past. How do you think movies have shaped our collective memories? Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And Peter Rollins, before the break, we were talking about Citizen Kane and as a movie that is interpretive of history. Obviously, that's fictional. The more straightforward film of this type might be the more recent release of something, The Alamo, for example, of the 87th, I think, version of that particular story.
Well, The Alamo, directed by John Lee Hancock, came out around Easter, not too long ago, and, of course, involves the 1836 siege on a small mission in northern Mexico. The Touchstone Pictures put in somewhere around $124 million, and they haven't gotten the money back. And the question has arisen, is it historical inaccuracy, dramatic inadequacy? What exactly are the drawbacks and virtues of this historical film?
Mm-hmm. And so those are films that at least address history straightforwardly. There's also a category you talk about that films that reflect history. What do you mean by that?
Well, motion pictures are often made, quote, just to entertain. Mm-hmm. However, in doing so, especially in genres such as the Western or the rural drama or the detective film, they often say a lot about the periods in which they are made, unintentionally in many cases, but they are sort of litmus tests of what is on the mind of the country or certainly the people who make films sometimes are ahead of the country, sometimes behind, but they are appealing to audiences on sensitivities that are current. And as a historian, I and others go back and look to see what messages are unintentionally communicated about the period in which the film has been made.
Well, here's a clip from the classic movie, The Maltese Falcon. It's after the death of his partner, Sam Spade's partner, and Joel Cairo comes to Sam Spade's office, of course, played by the great Peter Lorre, seeking the detective's help.
Now, what can I do for you, Mr. Cairo?
May a stranger offer condolences for your partner's unfortunate death?
Thanks.
Is there, Mr. Spade, as the newspapers imply, a certain relationship between that unfortunate happening and the death a little later of the man Thursby? I beg your pardon, no. More than idle curiosity prompted my question. See, Mr. Spade, I'm trying to recover ornament that, shall we say, has been mislaid.
Uh-huh.
I thought and hoped you could assist me. The ornament is a statuette, black figure of a bird. I am prepared to pay on behalf of the figure's rightful owner the sum of $5,000 for its recovery. I am prepared to promise that, what is the phrase, no questions will be asked.
That from The Maltese Falcon. Professor Rollins, what do we learn from history from The Maltese Falcon?
Well, there's a lot of interest today on the part of many scholars in cinema noir, cinema that has dark shadows, scenes at night, urban environment, and so on. And The Maltese Falcon of 1941 is sort of the classic model for cinema noir. What does it say about the 1930s? It says a lot. It says that the American dream is over, that the era lacks national purpose, and that people are very pessimistic about human nature and the potential for good in our society. The Maltese Falcon was based on a novel by Dashiell Hammett, mm-hmm. who was a very severe critic of the free enterprise system, as you know. And one might say that cinema noir was devoted to showing the moral bankruptcy of America in the 1930s.
And the moral uprightness of the paladins, the detectives like Sam Spade and Philip Marlowe, who have this code of their own that they take through this morally bankrupt land.
Well, this is a good point and is often pointed to, a sort of Hemingway-esque code which provides some kind of moral navigation. But within the context, it seems that there's very little else. Certainly no transcending force, and there's no transcending good occurring in history. This is an existential stopgap invented by the character to give some order to his life.
Let's get another caller on the line. Jennifer's with us from Chico, California.
Hi.
Hi.
You know, I just really wanted to add to this discussion the idea of whose perspective is, you know, from whose perspective is interpreting history is really where I think, you know, reality or truth comes into play. Like, if it's a woman, you know, if it's a slave who's, you know, presenting the story, or, for instance, speaking to the cinema question, the movie Agony and the Ecstasy, I believe, was a screenplay written by Gore Vidal about Michelangelo.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the story of Michelangelo, it had some facts in it, but I think that this, what people now see as what was important about Michelangelo is very different what I think a lot of us in art history would see of is important. So I'm just trying to make the point that I think the perspective of who's able to get the movie made, or who's acting in the movie, or who's writing the story that's being published,
mm-hmm.
is how our history gets established. And I guess that's your whole point of the show, to
yeah.
a degree.
Well, history is written by winners, or it was old A.J. Liebling's old line that the press is free to anybody who owns one. But
right.
Professor Rollins?
Well, this is a very good point by the caller. And often Hollywood is seen as an insular community, which has a certain mindset, which perhaps is not shared by many other communities in the nation. My interest is more in the area following this line of discussion, the Native American on film. We have an anthology called The Hollywood Indian, and really it's not until 1998 that Native Americans themselves have been able to tell the story of Native American culture or Native American history. And this is a clear case where finally the point of view of the people involved has come forward, because they were allowed or demanded they be given the right to write the films, direct them, and act in them.
Mm. We have a clip from I think one of the movies you're talking about, Smoke Signals. Here's a scene, two Native American boys, Victor and Thomas, talk about what it means to be an Indian while they're stuck on a long journey on a bus.
You know, Thomas, I don't know what you're talking about half the time. Why is that?
I don't know.
I mean, you just go on and on talking about nothing. Why can't you have a normal conversation? You're always trying to sound like some damn medicine man or something. I mean, how many times have you seen Dances with Wolves? 100, 200? Oh, jeez. You have seen it that many times, haven't you? Don't you even know how to be a real Indian?
I guess not.
I guess I'll have to teach you then, ain't it? First of all, quit grinning like an idiot. Indians ain't supposed to smile like that. Get stoic. You gotta look mean or people won't respect you. White people will run all over you if you don't look mean. You gotta look like a warrior. You gotta look like you just came back from killing a buffalo.
But our tribe never hunted buffalo. We were fishermen.
What? You wanna look like you just came back from catching a fish? This ain't Dances with Salmon, you know. Thomas, you gotta look like a warrior.
That from the movie Smoke Signals, obviously referring to the Kevin Costner movie Dances with Wolves throughout it. And one of the points that you make in this in the essay on or that's made in the essay about American Indians and the movies is that when whites are even if they're trying to make the Indians come off well, going back to what Broken Arrow and that sort of thing, or Dances with Wolves, it's really a film about white people. This is a film about Indians.
Absolutely, and this is a tremendous breakthrough in the history of Hollywood. In 1950, Broken Arrow clearly was a sensitive film that tried to address the issues of Indian culture, the communication between the whites and natives, and did so in a very advanced way for its time. But the central figure is Jimmy Stewart, and of course he's the white man.
Mm-hmm.
Little Big Man in 1970 is clearly an attempt to give a very positive interpretation of Native American culture. But here again, the central figure, played by Dustin Hoffman, is a white man. And, of course, Dances with Wolves is a similar sort of thing. That is, Kevin Costner is a Lieutenant Dunbar goes out mm-hmm. to sort of immerse himself in the countercultural values of the American West. So it's always about the impact on the white man, even when there's a sort of benevolent attempt to portray Indian culture. And what makes Smoke Signals and another film, which is very popular in the Indian community, Powwow Highway, so different is that everybody involved has a Native American cultural background. The scene that we just heard is fascinating, and you could parse that out in great detail. But essentially, what Victor is telling Thomas is that there are stereotypes of the American Indian that Thomas is going to have to conform to if he's going to be understood by the white culture, that neither Victor or Thomas share in these stereotypes, but they've got to somehow adopt them to be perceived as anything by the white culture. A fascinating observation. Professor Cobb, who wrote our essay on this, talks about this as the hegemonic block in which minorities have to become what other people expect them to be.
Let's get another caller in. Ken joins us from San Francisco.
Hi, how you doing? I'm thoroughly enjoying the show.
Thank you.
I'm a director in professional theater. I direct regional theater around the country. And two projects recently that I've done, one a very literal, more of a literal depiction of Will Rogers and the Will Rogers Follies. And the second project was one that was much more poetic and took all kinds of artistic license about the life of Bert Lahr, the Cowardly Lion.
Mm-hmm.
And with the Will Rogers, I mean, one of the other mitigating factors for me in researching this project for about 6 months before rehearsal started, as in film, there are a number of pressures as to how a show is put together, how a film is created, and in this case, in live theater. The show opened about 3 months after 9/11, and the producers met with me and said, is there any way that you can sweeten the patriotic message of Will Rogers, because our audiences need that? And for me, it was very difficult because there were so many things of Will Rogers. He became one of my heroes. But the construct of that play, that musical review, is really much more of a fluff. And so it was hard for me to have to compromise. But in the end, I won out by including what was Will Rogers' famous speech of the bacon, beans, and limousine speech, where he basically chastised. Hello?
Yeah. And I'm just trying to get a response from Professor Rollins. Obviously, outside events influence all kinds of decisions about movies and all kinds of projects, including Ken's theater projects.
By the way, I did not pay Ken to make this call.
Either.
1983, I wrote a book on Will Rogers, and part of my job at Oklahoma State was to help edit his writings. We produced 21 volumes. And I made a movie about him in 1976, so I'm intimately familiar with this topic. And what I can say to Ken is that, fortunately, you had such a multifaceted character that in sweetening it, all you needed to do was emphasize some components of what he said and maybe de-emphasize others. Now, Ken has mentioned the bacon, beans, and limousines speech. Rogers went on radio. He was probably next to Franklin Roosevelt, the most popular radio figure of the day, and really admonished American business community to get with it, help the New Deal, get the country going again. And Rogers, representing a agrarian hometown point of view, stated that we're all neighbors of each other and we need to help each other. So there is that sweet part in him that could be emphasized without too much trouble.
Ken, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're talking about American history and film with Peter Rollins, the editor of the newly published Columbia Companion to American History on Film. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. There's a third category that we haven't really discussed in any detail, and that's films that try to influence history in one way or another. I guess The Day After Tomorrow is coming out in a couple of weeks, would be in that category. But I think everybody would agree that Oliver Stone's movie JFK would be in this category. Again, we've got a clip from that movie, and this is a scene where the mysterious former military character X, played by Donald Sutherland, tells Kevin Costner's character Jim Garrison about various coincidences that occurred on the day that President Kennedy died.
Many strange things were happening, and your Lee Harvey Oswald had nothing to do with them. We had the entire cabinet on a trip to the Far East. We had one-third of a combat division returning from Germany in the air above the United States at the time of the shooting. At 12:34 p.m., the entire telephone system went out in Washington for a solid hour. And on the plane back to Washington, word was radioed from the White House Situations Room to Lyndon Johnson that one individual performed the assassination. Does that sound like a bunch of coincidences to you, Mr. Garrison?
No.
Not for one moment. The cabinet was out of the country to get their perceptions out of the way. Troops were in the air for possible riot control. The telephones didn't work to get the wrong stories from spreading if anything went wrong with the plan. Nothing was left to chance. He could not be allowed to escape alive.
And Peter Rollins, Oliver Stone in general, and JFK in particular, come in for a lot of discussion in your book.
Well, Oliver Stone is, of course, a terrific filmmaker. He is really a cinema artist, and I admire him for that. However, as a historian myself, I don't admire his historical methods and his constant search for conspiracy. The conspiracy approach to history is the amateur historian's approach to history. There are just too many disparate factors involved, and it's so satisfying to come up with a conspiratorial explanation. Simplifies the whole story. You know that this particular film, JFK, asserts that Bell Helicopter and certain Pentagon generals want Kennedy not to pull out of Vietnam, and that Lyndon Johnson's implied that Lyndon Johnson, the vice president, is going to assure that Kennedy does not do so. So the implication is Johnson's involved in the planned assassination. Everyone was worried, supposedly, because of Kennedy's hesitation at the Bay of Pigs invasion and his inability to, quote, stay the course. It all comes down to, I believe there's a rolling credit at the beginning of the film talking about the military-industrial complex, quoting, of course, Dwight D. Eisenhower as he left the presidential office. And for Oliver Stone, this is just one of the many interlocking directorates that run the world, pretty much a Marxist view.
We just have a minute or so left with you, and as we look at the continue talking about the history history on film, why is this important? Why is our sort of collective memory of this stuff formed by snatches of this film and that TV show? Why is all of that important?
Well, it all comes down to a term called visual literacy. Traditionally, our educational system has trained people how to read the page, how to look for point of view and subjectivity in writing. However, supposedly, motion pictures are true, and you have enough training just by being someone who attends a lot of them to dissect them for propaganda, for point of view, and so on. And it typically, people like me and many others take the position that you need to learn how to read motion pictures as much as you need to know how to read an editorial in a newspaper.
The book is The Columbia Companion to American History on Film. The editor is Peter C. Rollins, professor of English and American Film Studies at Oklahoma State University. He joined us from the studios of member station KWGS in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
When we come back, a review of Michael Moore's movie just won the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.